Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words that were originally formulated by Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This is widely available on all podcasting platforms and is sponsored by The Nation magazine. So this week, I want to take up some very curious behavior among the plutocrats. On Twitter or any other social media, sometimes you'll notice that it seems like a bit of an echo chamber, because you suddenly start seeing a lot of different people all making variations of the same point. And you're wondering, like, why is that going on? My guest here might be able to explain how it is that these echo chambers are created. It's Chris Lehman, my colleague at The Nation, a frequent guest of the program. And he recently wrote for The Nation magazine about a group chat created by plutocrats and their friends, which is an interesting window into the world of Silicon Valley and Trump. And I guess maybe one place to start is just the you know, as McLuhan said, the medium is the message. And the medium in this case is group chats. And they seem to be very much in the news, because there's also, more famously, group chats involving high government officials that were using Signal to, you know, share information on that platform that they should not be sharing. So Chris, maybe, like, just for listeners who might not be aware, what is this group chat phenomenon?
It's a curious thing. It actually has, in this case at least, it has its origins in spreading disenchantment among the kind of digitati on the right with existing social media platforms, during, the Biden years. Basically, there was this consensus that took shape there, suggesting that Twitter, and to a lesser extent, I guess, Facebook, were sort of engines of agitprop for liberals. And, you know, there would be Twitter mobs piling on dissenters. There would be, you know, things that just made people uncomfortable if they were a rich white male plutocrat.
And I mean, this is actually a longstanding feature of social media, which, you know, like, I'm not one to sort of celebrate the democratizing aspects of social media, which is always seen a bit propagandistic. But I think it is true that one of the interesting things about things like Twitter, maybe more in the old days, but it's still true, is that, people who, you know, don't necessarily think that, Tom Friedman is the fount of all wisdom, or David Brooks is the fount of all wisdom, can suddenly say so. And I think that the ruling class got more of a taste of, you know, what popular discontent sounds like than they are used to, or certainly than they are comfortable with.
Right. And then there's also the, you know, if you sort of lard in the, in my view, the sort of phony moral panic about the quote Twitter files and how the platform was allegedly, during the COVID pandemic, suppressing certain kinds of dubious information, which then became this rallying cry writ large on the right that all social media is, you know, this woke platform of censorship. So
but I mean it's curious that this persists even now, that, like, Twitter is owned by Elon Musk, who's, like, the most one of the most reactionary figures in American public life, and, you know, friends of Trump. And but also, I mean, like, you know, like, you have otherwise, you know, Facebook/Meta, which is owned by someone who's also increasingly aligned with Trump. And you have, they got everything they wanted. Well, you know, they're still unhappy.
Right. And this is, you know, persecution fantasies are very much integral to the modern right, going back you know, half a century at least. And I think, you know, it's something they're loath to get rid of, you know, because it generates a lot of pseudo populist discontent. And so, you know, the solution for this sort of group of elite influencers tied to Silicon Valley was to, instead of, you know, suffering the alleged censorship of Twitter or Facebook or what have you, was to create invitation only group chats. And this is where the fabled give and take that, you know, supposedly propelled Twitter's growth and is the great enabling force of social media is now sort of a gated community. And these are people, you know, of like mind on most critical issues, and certainly of similar temperament when it comes to things like feeling oppressed by wokeness, et cetera, would go to sort of vent and, you know, share political ideas, to swap jokes and links and what, you know, do everything that normally occurs on social media. And what the sort of most influential example of this is this group chat called Chatham House that is basically run under the aegis of Marc Andreessen, one of the famed venture capitalists of Silicon Valley, who founded Netscape, the first web browser, and is regarded as a sort of oracle of, you know, Valley, I don't know what to call it, thinking. you know, he is definitely an eager participant in all. He's a member of multiple chats and has been seen at public events just frenetically going back and forth on his phone from chat to chat, and he weighs in constantly. He, you know, it's sort of the way Elon Musk related to Twitter originally before he bought
which, you know, again, is a very curious, I mean, just a social phenomenon. Let's leave the politics aside. Like, you know, usually one thinks of the sort of, you know, social media obsessed like teenager, and I'm the father of like three girls, one of whom is a teenager, and you know, there's a certain truth to this idea of like it's there's a risk of you know, the screenager who's on their phone all the time, and I love, you know, like, you know, I'm obviously have some concern with, but I'm actually more concerned that like our plutocrats and billionaires are also like on their phones all the time. Like, you know, like, can we get back to like Rockefeller and JP Morgan? Like, those guys are serious guys who, you know, read books and, you know, like did long-term planning. Whereas like, it seems like with Musk and Andreessen and all these other guys, like they are literally mental teenagers who also have amassed enormous power and influence over the government.
Yeah, no, and you know, it is interesting. There was, you know, in the old WASP, you know, business elite, some sort of vague sense of civic noblesse oblige that you do actually, you know, have to give something back. You want to do some sort of public service, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, yeah, that mask has been ripped away from the ruling class. That you know, it's all about brand management, basically.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of thinking about this a little bit because I'm reviewing for The Nation as well this biography of William F. Buckley Jr., who, you know, like is, you know, like, you know, a problematic figure as we say nowadays on a host of issues. But you know, like, you know, this is a guy who wasn't as intellectual as he presented himself. Had like maybe a phony vocabulary, but it did actually read real books and engage with, certainly, like, you know, could converse with people like Nabokov on some level of engagement, and knew, you know, read Nabokov and knew who Nabokov was. And like now, you know, like these guys, they all seem like such caricatures, like, of what we're considered to be the worst traits of modern society, which I actually don't think are as pervasive in the general population as it is among the plutocrats. Like, these are, like, who one should worry about in terms of screenagers, who have, like, lost all attention span and lost the ability to rationality and critical thinking.
Yeah, and that's what's sort of comic about, you know, I sort of wrote this post based on Ben Smith at Semaphore had an expose of the Chatham House and also Andreessen's sort of precursor group chats. And there's all of this kind of bravura rhetoric surrounding it, you know, Andreessen himself calls them samizdat gatherings, you know, because they're getting out from under the thumb of the gray thought oppressors on the left. And, you know, other people refer to them as, you know, a republic of letters or an 18th century salon. And, you know, when you look at the actual content, you know, which was only reproduced sort of in paraphrase in Smith's piece, because he couldn't get many actual chat transcripts. But it's, you know, people bitching about cancel culture. It's people bitching about DEI. It is not Voltaire. It is not, you know, it is not remotely in the spirit of even, you know, I have, I'm sure, less love for social media than you do. It played a prominent role in the demise of my first marriage. So, but, you know, in the old Twitter, there was a rough kind of give and take, and you could have genuine arguments with people of differing points of view. So the first thing to note about, you know, the group chat phase of social media discourse is it's self-selecting. It's, you know, by invitation only, and it's all the sort of pre-anointed leaders of, you know, our digital economy, of the MAGA movement, sort of coalescing on the terms of engagement they prefer, which, you know, is certainly their prerogative, but it is uniquely kind of hostile to ideas as I understand them.
Like, yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to go back to the Buckley, like, example, like, you know, like Buckley, you know, like, for all his flaws and limitations, like, he went out and he debated, you know, James Baldwin, who bested him, and he debated Noam Chomsky, and he famously debated Gore Vidal, who, like, destroyed Buckley. But you know, like to give Buckley credit, you know, like, for all his, like, reactionary views, you know, bad politics, you know, sort of cronyism, whatever. He was actually, like, out there in the arena, like, engaging with, like, you know, actually the actual finest minds of the other side, like, on a playing field of some equality. This is not what these guys want.
No. And I think, you know, they just want to, you know, they want political debate to proceed roughly along the lines that they, you know, sort of manage their workforces. You know, they want people to sort of say what unbelievable visionary geniuses they are, to say how heroic they are for standing up to this groupthink of the left. So, sort of, and, you know, what's critical, and you know, Smith lays this out in his piece, is that the Andreessen group chat is kind of one of the main planks of the new accord between Silicon Valley and the MAGA right. I think there were always a lot of Silicon Valley leaders who were definitely MAGA curious, and, you know, liked certainly the tax cutting and broad economic aims of the first Trump administration. And Andreessen, you know, since he is sort of what passes for an intellectual in these circles, furnished a kind of safe space for all these people to, you know, let their MAGA hair down and you know, share their sense of grievance, to share their ideas, you know, again, using the term loosely, about how the economy and the political order should be arranged to sort of continue, you know, elevating them. And giving them, you know, praise and tax cuts and power.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. The political significance is this alliance between Silicon Valley and Trumpism. And I think it's actually useful to kind of step back, because I think there is a kind of myth that they themselves created, that they were good Democrats and then suddenly were mugged.
The party became too, and you know, like, so I mean,
the broader politics of kind of like Silicon Valley, and then, you know, like, one has to simplify a little bit, but there was always been this kind of, you know, libertarian, statist, and I has to say, kind of eugenicist, scientific racist thing. I mean, Peter Thiel, you know, was one of the founders of PayPal and then Facebook. And he, yeah, he's been thinking this way since the 90s. And there has been, this kind of, in the 90s, there was this kind of very interesting essay called The California Ideology.
I was just going to cite that.
Can you explain to listeners what the California Ideology, just so people have a background to know that this reactionary stuff has a history.
Right. These were two British academics who did a very prescient sort of breakdown of a libertarian ethos that was then, nascent in Silicon Valley and around the tech industry. And they did a very good job, I think, of saying, well, this is superficially, they're socially liberal on things like drugs or, some gender stuff, though that's, I think, changing now. But economically, they're quite reactionary, and they're quite, unbelievably doctrinaire in opposition to things like taxes and, definitely eager to deregulate any and all sort of obstacles to, the tech industry's dominance. So that core has always been there. And I think, because of the woeful nature of tech journalism, it was never really deeply reported on. I was associated with the Baffler from the 90s on, and we sort of made it one of our informal missions to continue hammering away. We called ourselves, the antidote to internet addiction early on. And, I'm proud, actually, that we were one of the first places to shine a bright light on Curtis Yarvin, who's another one of these characters who's elevated in these circles, and, to report on Peter Thiel's, deeply, I would say revanchist, quasi-monarchist worldview. So,
I think it's interesting to think like why people had these illusions, especially because of the Democrats. I mean, like under Clinton and Obama, there was a deliberate courting of Silicon Valley, and there was a kind of with the idea that this could be an alternative funding stream, along with some parts of finance capital versus the Republicans who had, the fossil fuel industry.
Right, the old extraction.
So the idea was like, the Democrats, we could help Silicon Valley, help them grow, give them a loose deregulatory background, and, also push the sort of social policies that they seem to like of social liberalism. But with the idea that, we'll have like some taxes, but we'll also be encouraging them. And in some cases, some of the industries, particularly Elon Musk, who's like, give them startup money or give them like funding. So a lot of Musk's projects, SpaceX, Tesla, were all dependent on government support. And then Musk at that point was a liberal hero. I mean, I think one should not forget this. Like American liberalism created this guy, right?
Right. And you still have people like Ro Khanna running around saying, oh, we shouldn't demonize Elon Musk. He's an innovator, blah, blah, blah. And not coincidentally, Ro Khanna represents the Silicon Valley district.
Yeah. No, so there is was a kind of like, there was an alliance, but like it took very little, for these guys, like the very modest push towards social democracy under Joe Biden for them to become reactionary.
They're unbelievably touchy for people who claim to, hold up values of robust debate or whatever. And this whole group chat phenomenon is a very clear demonstration of that. Like, they decided that they were being oppressed by social media, so they took their ball and went somewhere else. And, the fact that now, Twitter is a sort of fire hose of, fascist rancor, they're still not going to go back because they just like to be in their little cloistered, world where everyone is telling them how right they are and how brilliant they are.
No, as you mentioned, the touchiness is worth talking about because it also intersects with their relationship with journalism. You know, as you mentioned, the Baffler was trying to do was doing critical journalism, and there were certain other publications of which, you know, they Silicon Valley tried to destroy, like, or did destroy, like, you know, like Peter Thiel very famously destroyed Gawker. And so it is the case that, like, whenever anyone did any sort of critical reporting on them, they were very touchy. And now one sees it in the group chat where apparently, like, they're obsessed with Taylor Lorenz, who's like this former, you know, Washington Post journalist. You know, some of his views, you know, I might disagree with or whatever, but it's amazing that the wealthiest people in the world are obsessed with a former Washington Post reporter. But it just shows that, like, any sort of, like, outside critical view of, like, you know, is a danger to them.
Yeah, no, which gives, you know, makes the whole claim that this is a republic of letters that much more farcical, right? It's really a, you know, ideological compound of letters, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, like Musk also has a bunker, right? Like, it is. This is the a lot of these guys have bunkers. I mean, you know, like it's a big thing on Silicon Valley rich people to have these, like, you know, like apocalyptic.
Oh yeah, and Peter Thiel wants, you know, I think owns an island and or he has New Zealand citizenship and has a compound for when things get really.
Yeah, dark. It is a very curious. But I want to maybe underscore, think a little bit about why journalism as such threatens them so much. And I think it is literally because a lot of their business model is about like just making up nonsense, making up malarkey, you know, like making huge promises that cannot be fulfilled to get in venture capital money to get, like, you know, investors to put in that. You know, one sees this with Musk all the time where he's, like, you know, constantly promising things that, like, can never happen. He's like 10 years ago, he was promising, you know, by 2025, SpaceX would be colonizing Mars, you know? And so it seems like, you know, there's, what your piece really highlights is, you know, how hostile they are to free speech. And one of the reasons is just like actual scrutiny and journalism would actually threaten and destroy their whole project.
Yeah. And I think what's telling is that one of the forerunner groups, Andreessen founded was this group founded in the wake of the Harper's letter, which you also signed about, you know, the principle of we have to uphold the principles of free expression, which is true. But
I meant it.
No, right. And clearly Mark Andreessen, you know, there were many codicils to his support of this, because what happened to this group is that two of its members, one of whom is Thomas Chatterton Williams, now a writer at The Atlantic, penned an op-ed in the New York Times decrying on free speech grounds the moral panic over critical race theory in the schools. And that blew up the entire group, because for the, you know, the Silicon Valley lords, this was just a betrayal. You know, they understood free speech, you know, dedication to free speech as basically, you know, supporting the speech that we agree with and suppressing the speech we don't.
And
Williams and his three co-authors, you know, pointed out the obvious contradictions in that view. You know, Andreessen went after Williams at a very personal level and then blew up the whole group and started a new one. With Richard Hanania, who at that time was a, you know, self-declared white nationalist who, Andreessen's charge was to, you know, find me a chat full of smart right wingers, basically, which, you know, he definitely met the right wing part of that formulation. But that becomes another sort of exercise in groupthink. And Hanania, who is now sort of on the outs with the anti-woke right, said in Ben Smith's piece that, you know, he just felt I'm just creating another mechanism for groupthink. All these people are afraid to criticize Trump election denialism because, you know, it's a fable they think of as necessary to hold on to power. And, you know, that's many things, but it's not, again, in the spirit of philosophes of, you know, the Enlightenment.
Yeah, I don't, absolutely. And
the other thing about the, you know, the claim that they were recreating salon culture that's hilarious is that, you know, one of the other themes of the Chatham House group was to continue to sort of sane-wash the demented social thinking of Curtis Yarvin, who is a self-avowed monarchist. Like, the French Revolution, you know, culminated, or the Enlightenment culminated in the French Revolution, which killed the king. And here, reverse, you know, photographic image of that. We have people who think they're enlightened, you know, philosophes elevating monarchists. So,
yeah. I mean, the monarchist stuff is, as you say, very telling. But I mean, it is all part of this general meme or intellectual structure that they have of, you know, conservatism is the new punk rock. And so therefore, if you uphold hierarchy, plutocracy, reactionary gender norms, reactionary racial hierarchy, you're punk rock.
Ross Douthate just had an interview at the New York Times with another basically fascist, you know, thought leader in this world who's, you know, saying, you know, we revel in basically misogyny and patriarchy, blah, blah, blah. And it's, yeah, there is the obvious objection that none of this is new, especially on the right. And what's more, you know, it's, I mean, I would make two points. One is there is this kind of reflexive, uncritical, you know, business hero worship going on, you know, where everyone, you know, in Mark Andreessen's orbit is sucking up to him, you know, to get whatever cachet and cash they can out of that arrangement. But they also, you know, think of themselves as miniature Mark Andreessens. They're, you know, these heroic, telling difficult truths to, you know, a benighted liberal culture that's dying, blah, blah, blah. And there's also just this, you know, and I have debated Curtis Yarvin. I've been in, you know, these circles. And what's striking is the absolutely denuded worldview of, you know, that creates this vision of politics where, you know, there is no such thing as a popular social movement. It's all just sort of machinations within some dark corner of the deep state. And there has to be, you know, broken down and basically annexed to Silicon Valley, which is what I would argue the Doge Project is. It's just a very imaginatively dead and unpersuasive account of human behavior. Like there's no world in which, you know, a kind of liberated tech platform is going to create meaningful social change, except for the worst, obviously. Like, and everyone in these chats is, you know, just so diehard in this, you know, idea that everything that government does by definition must be unproductive and, you know, an obstacle to true innovation. And everything that correspondingly that, you know, whatever eructation comes out of a Silicon Valley lord is genius, you know, and it's just, you know, nobody lives in that world.
No. And it's a very, I don't know. I mean, even on their own level, like, it's like, it's such an unsatisfying, it seems so unsatisfying, and maybe explains why they're also always so angry and
frustrated. Yeah, I know. You know, these are people who have been like had their posteriors kissed by every aspect of our culture, and yet they're angry. They feel oppressed. It is a deep mystery at that level.
Yeah. Except that, I mean, like, what they actually want in some ways is like impossible, which is like total subservience of everyone. Like, they, you know, they want a world where they will never have. That's why monarchists.
Mark Andreessen just had a interview clip that's hilarious, where he basically says, "Yeah, AI is gonna, you know, replace every single job except for that of venture capitalist, because that requires this brilliant intuition that only I have, essentially." So, like, his vision of an ideal future is one in which we're all sort of, you know, hooked up to the matrix with AI capacities, and he's just continuing to make deals.
Yeah, yeah, which again, it's hard to see what's in it for everyone. I mean, even in terms of like monarchy, you know, like at least the French Bourbons, they built Versailles.
projects. So
they, yeah, yeah, they had they had like national projects of various sorts. It is a very bizarre thing. But I mean, you know, since we talked about Anderson so much, it should be noted that he is Anderson Horowitz, and the Horowitz of Anderson Horowitz is Ben Horowitz, who is the son of David Horowitz.
Find this angle.
Which again, like, maybe points to some of the ideological origins. Ben Horowitz, not too long ago was a big donor to the Democratic Party, and people always found that a bit anomalous because his father, David Horowitz, is a famous reactionary, but now I think Ben Horowitz's politics are much more in alignment with what they always were, much more honest about what they always were, and he's a Trumpist. But David Horowitz, for listeners, and the nation will be having an obituary about him soon, but he, a famous red diaper baby, came from parents who were in the Communist Party. He became disillusioned with the 1956, which to my mind is a little bit late in the day, but in any case.
Your trials were fine, evidently. So.
But then later became very active in the New Left, was editor of Ramparts magazine, a strong supporter of the Black Panther Party, and became disillusioned and he's one of these guys always just writes autobiographies, like Charles de Gaulle wrote 3 autobiographies, and that's kind of justified because he was a great 20th century figure. David Horowitz, I think, wrote like 6 or 7 autobiographies. But they're all about this tale. Yeah. Yeah. He wrote about what he knew, which was his life, and which was the trauma, he claimed, was the, a murder of a friend, allegedly, it's never actually been proven, but he thinks by the Black Panthers. But a decade and a half later, once the right was triumphant in Washington, a decade and a half after that supposedly traumatic event, then he turns to the right and comes out with a book called Destructive Generation, and has this Second Thought Foundation, and really becomes, it's very interesting because in some ways, I think a lot of the older conservatives even found him embarrassing. Like Horowitz would complain about how, the Wall Street Journal or the National Review would not review his books. And because his books were basically like, Obama is a communist. And that's a little bit, but he kind of had this continued anger and like hatred of the left. At a period where, one could argue there's some left in America, but like it's not like the Communist Party
And it's really interesting because Yarvin also has this obsession with the Communist Party as sort of the fount of all sort of liberalism in modern America. And in my debate with him, and he also comes from a family. I think his parents were at least, Pinkos. I don't know what their formal affiliation with the party was. He has this whole sort of grand narrative vision of history where the communists are basically doing everything. He made a great deal over the fact that, sort of Martin Luther King's senior advisor was a party member, which, I think I said in the debate, like, Martin Luther King was always a socialist. Like, you're not really exposing much here.
I don't know. To my mind, stop making communism cool.
It's just a weird thing to, and that was sort of when I realized, like, oh yeah, for this mindset, there can't be a popular movement. It has to be manipulated from above like, you know, marionette or puppeteers, right? So
yeah. No, it is a kind of conspiracy theory view of history. And it makes sense he's a monarchist, because that is actually how the French monarchist viewed the French Revolution, which was like, you know, this great
conspiracy, right?
Yeah, introduction of the masses into like history. But if you look at, if you still, I mean, they're still French monarchists. If you talk to them, it's like, well, actually, it was the Duke of Orleans and the Freemasons, and maybe like, you know, certain people that you want to put three brackets around their names.
I mean, that's sort of what's interesting too, is I do think, you know, subconsciously that vision of history works out for the Silicon Valley elite in such a way that they want to audition to be the replacement, you know, cabal. They actually, you know, I said something right away in my debate with Yarvin that was dismissive of American communists, and he was like, oh no, I have like nothing but respect for them. And it's just like, wow, okay.
On this point, one of David Horowitz's books was titled The Shadow Party, How George Soros, Hillary Clinton, and 60s Radicals Seize Control of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and, you know, like I've reviewed Dinesh D'Souza's books, which are just a hoot, because they just have, you know, he literally in his book about his, you know, 10 months in custody where he was at a halfway house, all stems from this. He was absolutely convinced that Barack Obama himself was hounding D'Souza on a listserv. Like, it was just like, you can't, you know, this makes Captain Ahab look, you know, normal.
Actually, like, I'm very glad you mentioned that, because, again, not to harp on David Horowitz too much, but like, in one of their books, David Horowitz and his frequent collaborator, Peter Collier, had, it was called Deconstructing the Left. And he says, they say at the introduction, for some of us former radicals, the left is always this great white whale that we have to destroy. And, you know, we have sightings of it and we will harpoon it. And so basically implicitly saying that they are Ahab. And again, this is like, you know, like, please read a book. I want to, like, maybe this is a personal pet peeve, but I want to mention that one of the group chats was called the James Burnham Fan Club. And it is the case that many of these people on the right have tried to resurrect the this figure, James Burnham.
Another former communist.
Former Trotskyist, and became a sort of Cold War liberal, and then supporter of McCarthy and a founding editor of National Review. And I noticed that Winklevoss, one of these plutocrats, was praising Burnham, but basically making it sound like this is like a libertarian who was complaining about the free market and the government taking over the economy, and citing the book called The Managerial Revolution, which is one of, James Burnham's big theoretical book, coming out after he's a Trotskyist. And I just want to say, like, you know, like, I know none of these people have read James Burnham, because that is not, Burnham was not a libertarian by any stretch of the imagination. He's an authoritarian coming out of, like, Trotskyism and that movement. He said, like, you know, capitalism will not be replaced by socialism. It will be replaced by this system, managerial revolution, which we're seeing all over the world, of bureaucratic control. And this is inevitable. And we just have to live with it. And later he refined it to say, you know, one can have circulation of elites within the managerial society. And he wanted his own elite of reactionaries to be on top. But having said that, like, he is not by any stretch of the imagination, free market, deregulate the economy guy. In fact, famously, like, in, you know, he, although he's a reactionary, he loved Robert McNamara, because McNamara at the Pentagon was doing managerial
control. Those principles. So, absolutely.
So again, I know this sounds like a snotty liberal kind of point of view, but please read a book. Please.
Right. No, I know. I mean, that's the thing, is the actual knowledge of history is like this thin in these exchanges. And it is, it is maddening. And you do think that if these discussions were being conducted in public, there would be some mechanism to correct these massive misperceptions, potentially. on that.
Yeah, I don't want to necessarily take credit or blame for this, but I did actually notice that when Burnham's the first attempt was made to resurrect Burnham, I would get into these Twitter exchanges with people on the sort of reactionary end of things, and I would just point out, first of all, Burnham had I think it was Orwell who said this, but, you know, noted that Burnham has this like spectacular record of false predictions, starting with the Manager of Revolution, where he predicted that Germany would win the Second World War. Afterwards, predicting that unless the U.S. destroys the Soviet Union through preemptive nuclear war, the Soviet Union would take over the world. He also said that the Soviet-Chinese split was a ruse and did not actually happen, was designed to fool the West. And when I would bring these up, you know, that would kind of shut down the conversation. So I can imagine the value of going into a group chat and, like, you know, where you could spot off about Burnham without actually encountering
any blowback or consequences.
Burnham
also wrote Suicide of the West, right? That was
yes. Which again was basically predicted, like, as many of the National Review conservatives did, that the Soviet Union would win. Like, Whitaker Chambers famously said, "You know, I'm leaving the winning side for the losing side." And, you know, like, I have to say, we can actually evaluate these claims.
I know, right?
That is and see if they were
there's a historical record.
Which, again, maybe part of the sort of California ideology, the sort of postmodern world. But I mean, there is a kind of thinness of engagement with history.
Yeah, well, I lived in California for a long time, and I can report that, yeah, they don't, the whole idea of history doesn't go down well there.
History is breakfast.
Right, exactly.
but I do think that, like, maybe the one value, or not value, but I mean, the troubling thought to maybe leave listeners with is that although these people know nothing, have crackpot ideas, they unfortunately, through the ruse of history, now have the ear of the president.
Yeah, and they are now the winning side.
Yeah, they are the winning side. So I think it's kind of important to know what these people are thinking, even as they hide behind group chats.
Yeah, absolutely.
So again, Chris, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.